Okay, so we might as well get started. And today we have Waddy Taylor, along with a surprise guest lecturer. And their title will be an introduction to string field theory.
Great. Okay, so as Steve said, this is actually, and contrary to the announcement, this will be a tag team talk. And in fact, the other half of the talk will be given by Steve himself. Actually, maybe I could have a light on the board, because I'm going to be talking on the board. Oh, thanks. So, as most of you know, string field theory has sort of come back into vogue in the last year or so, after a long period of being regarded as a rather esoteric and complicated thing. There's been a lot of work done on this, in particular in the context of tachyon condensation in the last year and a half, based on these conjectures of Asrock Sen. And the organizers asked me to give sort of an introductory talk where I'm really not going to talk much about the tachyon condensation story, but really just trying to give you a sense of what string field theory is. And really, in particular, there's one very well-defined string field theory, which is Witten's cubic bosonic string field theory. So I really want to focus on that. And in starting to...
There's the light cone also.
Yes, I'm sorry. There's also the light cone. Good. So Steve will also kibitz during the... So in starting to think about what to talk about, I realized that some of the main important early results on this were, in fact, Steve and collaborators' work. And I talked to Steve, and Steve agreed to discuss some of these aspects himself, since he's was involved in those some years ago. So here's sort of the outline of what I'm going to talk about. First part, which will be given by me. I'll start with some orientation, just some general words. I'll tell you what Witten's cubic bosonic string field theory looks like. And then I'll say a few things about how to do explicit calculations of the terms in the action of this theory. Because if you look at the papers that have appeared over the last year, a lot of them are filled with these incomprehensible equations which just go on and on and on. And this at least will give you, in principle, some idea of how to generate any one piece of those calculations if you so desire. Then Steve will go on, and he will talk about some aspects of this theory. In particular, he'll talk about the Feynman rules and this important question of how this theory covers the moduli space of Riemann surfaces. At least that's what I think he's going to talk about. Is that a good characterization of here?
Yeah, and I'll say something about closed strings.
Great, and he'll say something about closed strings. Okay, so we're going to try to divide this roughly in half. I don't actually have my watch, so maybe you could give me a heads up about after 20 minutes, 25 minutes or so. Okay, so what is string field theory all about? By the way, if any of you are really experts on string field theory, you probably won't learn much, so you can either tune out, do something else, or I won't be at all offended if you leave. This is really meant to be sort of an introductory thing. There will be, I guess, a number of talks later in the workshop on more technical, more recent work, particularly related to the tachyon condensation issue. But this will be sort of a warm-up for some of those later talks. Okay, so how does string theory work? Well, we have string states, which are in the Hilbert space of excitations of an individual string. And each one of these corresponds to a space-time field, as we well know. So, for example, if we take the open bosonic string, we have some state. We have the vacuum state, the lowest energy, the lowest lying state in the string spectrum. That corresponds to a tachyon in space-time, which I'll call phi, with m phi squared equals minus 1 over alpha prime. Okay, so this tachyon has, of course, always been a big problem for bosonic strings, bosonic open strings in particular. If you move up the spectrum, we have a vector field, which we get by acting with the lowest matter raising operator. That becomes a massless U1 field A mu. And then if we keep acting with raising operators, we get some massive fields like b mu nu with a mass squared of 1 over alpha prime. So we get this infinite hierarchy of massive fields, and then we get a massless spectrum, and then a tachyon. A similar thing happens in the closed string. In the closed bosonic string, again, we have a tachyon. And then we have, of course, g mu nu, b mu nu, and the dilaton phi, which are the massless fields, etc. Then there's a bunch of massless fields in that. Now, we want to understand the space-time physics of string theory. So there are a number of different things we can do to try to understand that space-time physics. Traditionally, what people do, the simplest thing to do, is to construct vertex operators associated with each of these things, and then to write conformal field theory correlation functions. And these conformal field theory correlation functions corresponds to essentially a set of perturbation theory rules for the space-time fields. Okay. So this is well and fine as far as perturbation theory goes, but of course we really want to write down a theory in space-time, not just a bunch of rules for moving from correlation functions to individual interactions. So the question we want to ask is, does this come from some field theory? Okay, now a simple way of getting at such a field theory is through looking at the low energy effect of action, which is another thing that we do a lot. So we can look at the low energy effect of action. That basically means that we take our string theory, we couple it to some background. So we couple to a background, either a mu in the case of an open string, or g mu nu, b mu nu, and phi, where usually we only couple to a massless background. And then we can look at the condition of conformal invariance for the string theory in this background. That corresponds to the vanishing of the Weyl anomaly, which gives us some beta functions, whose vanishing gives us the equations of motion for some low energy effective theory. Right? Now, this gives us an on-shell set of equations for the massless fields in the theory. So this is missing two things. First of all, it's missing the off-shell physics. And second of all, it's missing all the massive fields. So the goal of string field theory is to remedy those shortcomings by producing a theory which is really a space-time theory of this infinite set of fields, which includes all the off-shell physics and includes all the massive fields.
So the effects of massive fields can be present in this description if you include the alpha prime corrections, right?
Absolutely. That's right. We can, if we do various calculations, we can see the alpha prime corrections to the equations of motion, like the alpha prime corrections to Einstein's equations. But we're only really seeing them through their effects on the massless fields. And again, we're only seeing the on-shell equations, essentially, and we don't have any access to the off-shell physics. So what we really want is some set of equations of motion which include all the massive fields as degrees of freedom which have not been integrated out. But what you say is exactly right. Yeah, feel free, you know, there's lots of experts in the audience on string field theory and everything else, so please just jump in if you want to. Well, string field theory does not proceed in the same way as this calculation of the low energy effect of action. In principle, one could try to couple all the massive fields to the conformal field theory. But string field theory generally proceeds in a slightly different way. Okay, so basically string field theory is going to be some space-time action for the infinite set of string fields. And basically, we want this action to have the property that the Feynman diagrams of this action produce all of the perturbative theory, at least. And that means that the Feynman diagrams of this have to cover exactly once the moduli space of Riemann surfaces which we normally think of as the Riemann surfaces on which we do individual conformal field theory calculations. So that's what Steve is going to address in his part of the talk, is exactly how that works for a simple, for the string field theory that we really have some understanding of. As I'll say, we sort of know how to do this in a polynomial fashion for the open bosonic string, but it seems to be difficult for any other string. So in particular, string field theory includes the massive fields and the off-shell physics. And another very important thing is, okay, so it includes massive fields, off-shell physics, and furthermore, string field theory allows us to change the background. It's a background independent formulation of string theory. And this is, of course, one reason that it's of great interest. Yes, lots of people are going to scream here.
That's very misleading.
Okay. Yeah.
Most people mean, by background independent, mean that you don't need to pick a background image right down Lagrangian.
Right.
And of course, for Witten's theory, you do. You have to define Q, and Q requires...
Absolutely. Absolutely. But I guess what I mean is that looking at a small variation in the background can be seen within the context of the string field theory itself.
Wait. To write down Witten's open string field theory, you need to specify a closed string background. But it's independent of the open string background fields in the sense you just said. It can be formulated for arbitrary figures of the open string field. So it's dependent on the closed string background, but not on the open string background. So it's partially background independent.
Right. So there's sort of a holy grail here, which is a closed string field theory, which would be background independent, in the sense that if you write it down starting with a particular background, you would then be able to deform it away by just looking at things within the context of that theory. And that's the sense in which it is background independent to a greater extent than, for instance, matrix theory or the ABS-CFT correspondence, where we again have a background dependence, but you can't see how to shift the background quite as well.
Well, I don't want to belabor the point, but I think ABS-CFT is much more background independent just because the only dependence you need is a boundary condition. And it really is a correspondence for all closed strings on all gravity things, as long as they're asymptotic.
Right.
So that's a lot less dependent on that.
Okay, well, I'm not going to say too much about background independence, so let's leave that be. But there are various senses in which string field theory might have some nice things to say about choices of background in string theory. I won't get too far into that.
Can you say what the data is you need to specify string field theory? It's just a closed string conformal field theory, or is it any 2D field theory, or what would you need?
Well, we only know how to really construct one well-behaved, well-defined string field theory. In principle, if we have a conformal field theory, we would like to believe that there's a string field theory which does this thing of covering the moduli space with some simple action. The bosonic closed string field theory, for instance, seems to do that, but you have to add interactions of all orders, which makes it kind of complicated. In principle, I suppose you could do that kind of a prescription for any conformal field theory. You could generate vertices at each order, see how much of the moduli space you've covered, and then stick in some new vertices for whatever you haven't covered. So in principle, I guess it should be possible for any conformal field theory. But whether you get sort of a nice, well-behaved, simple theory is a little less clear. I mean, for instance, even for the open superstring theory, it's rather technically difficult to construct the cubic open string field theory, even for the flat space background. I mean, Witten sort of had a formulation much like what I'm going to describe in the bosonic case, but it seems to run into some problems. So it's this alternative formulation of Berkowitz, and it's complicated. I don't know exactly in what sense you meant your question.
Well, to formulate the open string field theory, right. you do just need to specify. You need a closed string conformal field.
But you don't need a closed
string. You need a solution to the closed string equations of motion.
Yeah.
That's to say a conformal field theory, which in particular supplies with the BRST operator.
So any conformal field theory is okay, but not any 2D field theory.
Not
any
off-shell
and closed string also.
That's right.
Yeah, I mean, a crucial thing, as I'll say, is having some BRST operator, which you can use to sort of build the theory on. That seems to be a sort of minimal thing that you need. Okay, so that's sort of the orientation part. Any other general questions about things before I talk about Witten's bosonic open string theory? Okay, so of the various attempts to construct string field theory, the one which seems to give the nicest, most well-behaved theory is this approach of Witten to a cubic open bosonic string theory. So let me describe that in a little bit of detail. So we start with the BRST operator, Q, for the open bosonic string. Now, the reason that this thing is very important is because we get the physical spectrum of the theory by looking at states annihilated by Q. So states annihilated by Q for some state in the string Hilbert space are physical states. And then we consider two states to be equivalent. If they differ by the Q of some other state. So that actually what we mean when we talk about physical states are the cohomology classes of this BRST operator Q. So we just have to look at the kernel knotted out by the image. We get the BRST cohomology. That's the physical spectrum of states in the theory. So we want to start with this operator, which selects out the physical states and constructs some kind of an interacting string field theory. So the next thing we need to talk about is what is a string field. So roughly speaking, a string field is some functional on the space of all possible string trajectories. So take all possible string trajectories, write down some functional on that. One way of expressing such a functional is to write a formal expansion in terms of the to write a formal expansion in terms of the Fock space of the theory and the set of string fields. Okay, so we can represent such a functional in terms of a state in the Hilbert space where the coefficients of each state in the basis are given by functions in some, say, momentum representation. Okay? So what we want to do is write down an interacting theory for this string field, which I'll call phi. Okay? So Witten wrote down an incredibly nice, simple action for this string field. Yeah?
Just to understand the notation, did you mean phi as a state on the left-hand side there, or did you mean a functional?
Well, here phi is a functional, but I'm going to write it in this way because it formally lives in some sense in the Hilbert space. You know, it's written as a sum of functions.
Okay, then I'm a little bit confused because the left-hand side is some number, right?
Well, no, this is a function which assigns to every string configuration a number.
Okay, and on the right-hand side, to every string configuration, I assign a state? Or?
Yeah, so for instance, I guess this would be written as
this in some
x basis of the states, if you wish. Yeah. So phi as a functional with no argument would be something like, yeah, okay. So this would be the particular value of phi as evaluated on some position space string configuration. Okay, so what does Witten's theory look like? Well, most of you have seen this. It looks like okay, there's a quadratic term and a cubic term. And basically, this takes the form of a Chern-Simons type of action. The various objects here, Q is the BRST operator. Let me note, by the way, that the Hilbert space H has a natural grading. It's graded by ghost number. And Q maps the Hilbert space of one ghost number into the set of states of one greater ghost number. So Q essentially carries ghost number 1. The star product operation as defined by Witten, basically takes one string and a second string and glues the two strings together by cutting each precisely at the midpoint and putting essentially a delta function overlap relating the right half of the first string to the left half of the second string. Now, the ghost number, we can define the ghost number in such a way that this star product really defines a graded algebra. Okay, and I'll come back to the specific ghost number assignation to individual states in a bit. But one of the nice mathematical structures that comes out here is that this is really a graded algebra. Okay? And finally, we need some concept of integration, which basically assigns to a string what you get if you take the string, glue the right half to the left half, and again put some sort of a delta function interaction, asserting that the two sides of the string have to have the same thing going on. Because of ghost number anomaly cancellation, you need to have a state of ghost number 3 for this to happen. Okay. So this is basically a Chern-Simons type theory. The equations of motion are just q phi plus phi star phi equals 0.
What?
Yep.
Sorry, could you say again what that diagram means?
This one or this one?
Well,
either one.
Particularly the operation of folding and doing with the delta function.
Yeah. Okay, so I can describe it explicitly on the Fock-space basis, which I'll do presently.
Okay.
But, I mean, conceptually it just means you take this string, it's some functional, as I had written here, it's a functional of x of sigma, and you basically just say that there's a delta function relating x of sigma right to the x of sigma left.
Good.
So you're saying that the left-hand side, you know, if this part of the string is at, you know, this point in space-time, then this point in the string also has to be at the same point. And you have to be a little careful in being precise about how to calculate with that, but conceptually you're just saying that the two sides of the string are mirror images of each other in terms of how the string is.
And this really is in space-time, I guess.
And also, you have to do it with the ghosts also.
Right.
Yeah.
So all the...
All the fields, yeah.
It might be useful just to say that if you think of the string field as a matrix where you can have, you know, the string divided up into left half and right half, then this is just matrix multiplication.
Exactly.
Infinite by infinite matrix.
Exactly. Although there are some problems with really representing it in that way.
Yeah.
There's some technical difficulties with representing it in that way because of funny things that happen at the midpoint. But that's a very good conceptual way of thinking about it.
And what was the motivation for this?
Well, basically, he wanted to write down an interacting theory that gave us something which had the same physical states at the linear level as the usual string theory. If we look at this equation of motion, this is the linearized theory. So the linearized theory gives us the usual physical spectrum, right? Because the equation of motion is exactly the same. But we also get interactions. So, I mean, who knows exactly what was going on in his head. He obviously had some inspiration which led to this. But, you know, if you start with Q and you write down something that sort of ends up formally looking like this, one natural way of completing it is a Chern-Simons type of thing. I mean, if you think, okay, this is a graded algebra, this is like an exterior derivative, it's like ADA. You know, if somebody hands you an integral of ADA and says, what interaction term do you need to put in? I mean, it makes it all look almost, you know. But obviously you had to put it in that form. But anyway, this gives us this interacting theory. This theory now has a nice invariance.
And part of the stroke of genius there was to formulate in that language.
Right. To even think of writing it in terms of, for instance, a star product is not at all
really
obvious.
I'm asking about the star product. So what is the motivation for that? If I just knew perturbative string theory, the way I do
that. Part of the motivation was that you know, there was this guess that it had something to do with a non-commutative geometry, which in a sense
this is a realization. And so you need to generalize the notion of plotting.
Mm-hmm. A more pedestrian motivation, I think, was just the fact that we had this intuition that all you need was a three-string vertex. Right. Rather than find a diagram, if you like the string diagrams, and everything can be followed as sort of two strings joined into one. So in terms of a field theory, you have to find a way of cutting it so you can actually divide it up into vertex and propagators, and a three-string vertex is naturally sort of described by some sort of things like that in the points.
Yeah. For instance, to just take off on that a little bit, if you tried to define this product in a different way, like if you cut this string a third of the way along and this string two-thirds of the way along, you could still define a perfectly nice theory, but you would discover that you didn't exactly get all the right interactions unless you included other terms of quartic order and higher order, and you'd end up with some non-polynomial theory. I guess, as Gary was saying, there was some intuition in the air that you should be able to do this just with the cubic interaction, and you know, people had seen that in certain contexts, I guess. So that was part of the motivation to look for something like that. Okay. So we have this nice invariance. It's invariant under delta phi is q lambda plus g, by the way, is the open string coupling. I forgot to mention. Okay, so it's basically an interacting theory. It gives you the same physical spectrum and has this nice this nice invariance. To see that it has the invariance, basically all you need to do is write down this action and a few formal properties of Q and the star product and the integral, which is kind of a nice fact because it makes this into a fairly abstract thing. Basically, if we have Q squared equals 0, Q on A star B equals QA star B plus minus 1 to the grading of A star QB. We need integral of A star B equals minus 1 to the grading of A grading of B, B star A. Sorry, no minus out there. And integral of QA equals 0 for all A. If you just put in these conditions, you can see that at each order in G, this action has the right gauge invariance. These are all things that are satisfied by a wide class of objects. And this, in particular, in this string field theory case, the star product defined by gluing strings together, the BLST operator of the string, and the integration defined in this way end up satisfying this. Yes, Sean?
So you're going to tell us now that when you expand in G, you generate open string diagrams, I guess. And I have an elementary confusion, which is that if you do some example, like where there's a space-filling grain,
right.
At one loop order, closed strings know that they're no longer in a good background. And they'll want to shift the closed string background because they'll know that the brain has tension.
Right.
Whereas here, you've chosen a fixed closed string background and a Q operator.
Yep.
And do the open strings at some order in G string realize that the closed string background needs to be shifted and is sick? Or does this define a...
Isn't this sort of the open string, closed string duality in some sense? That you write down the open string theory, it looks like it's in flat space.
So will they see the Dalton tadpole at one closed string loop from the tension of the brain? Or?
Well, you're only looking at interactions on the open string.
Yeah, still.
I mean, look at the annulus diagram in this theory. The question is there a
I don't think you
tadpole from a corner of the moduli integration?
Yeah, I don't think you see it, but
there should be. It has to be produced. Right. It has to be produced, that divergence.
Right. Well, if it's not doing the right thing. But if there is, you have to set the closed string background also, not just the open string background. That's what modifies.
Right.
So you have to modify Q order by order in the expansion?
So maybe there's something like Fischler suspense?
Yeah, basically. I mean, how that gets implemented in string field theory.
Right, that's a good question. So Q is actually Q sub G, and you modify it.
I don't think you're ever going to actually modify Q. I mean, it might be sort of a...
This calculation reproduces the usual standard rules of calculating S-matrix diagrams, right?
Yes, that's what Steve's going to tell you about.
They involve also the Fischler-Suskind mechanism. So whatever you do in string field theory will also have to encounter this modification of Q order by order to cancel the divergence in loop diagrams.
Right. So you're claiming you have to modify Q of the open string.
Well, when,
it's a good question.
You encounter such a divergence, you either stop and say it's time to go home, or you start doing Fischler Susskind. And I think, as far as string field theory went, I think we went home.
Yes. Okay. Okay, good. So it's actually almost Steve's turn to be up. So why don't you save that question for Steve? Because he'll think about it. So Steve will figure that out. Why. Okay. So let me just say a few things about how to explicitly calculate this action. I won't go into great detail, but because a lot of the recent work involves basically taking this theory and doing lots of calculations to understand this process of tachyon condensation, it's kind of nice to be able to actually make this explicit by writing down all the things we just discussed in the Hilbert space language. So let me not go into too much gory detail about this, but if we basically, okay, so we have this Fock space. If this is the SL2R invariant vacuum, there's a ghost number one vacuum, which I'll call zero hat. And this, in the language of Joe's book, is zero matter tensored with the down state in the ghost sector. Okay. And this thing is annihilated by all the raising operators with positive modes of all the C's, B's, and alphas. We can write an expansion of the string field. As we said before, if we just restrict to ghost number one, phi of p, zero hat, plus a mu alpha mu minus one, zero hat, plus et cetera. And now we can try to write down explicit Fock space realizations of each of these things to do a calculation of some terms in the action. So let me just give you a sense of how this works, for instance, for the terms in phi, so explicit. Okay, so first of all, let's do the quadratic terms. We have integral of phi star q phi. Now, a convenient way of writing this thing, rather than writing it in terms of the star product, is to write it in terms of what's called the BPZ inner product. What does that mean? Well, the basic idea is that we define the dual of a state. So A going into B is defined to be basically the conformal field theory correlator, where we take I of A hitting B. Let me make it more. I guess this is OA, OB, where I is, I of Z is minus 1 over Z. So basically, we're taking two string field theory states, we're mapping one off to infinity, keeping one at the origin, and then we're looking at the inner product in this way. So you can realize this explicitly in the Fock space language. So for instance, if we have a state A, which is equal to a product of a bunch of raising operators, alpha M1 mu B, what notation did I use? B minus M1 dot 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 C minus N1 dot 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 alpha mu 1 minus P1 on a state, then basically what we get back after doing the BPZ dual is we get the same state with all the operators in the same order. We change the signs on all of them. And we get a minus 1 to a certain power, which basically is the sum of the levels plus the number of alphas plus the number of C's, because we get one for every, minus one for every operator of odd dimension. So B is associated with a conformal field theory operator dimension 2, C minus 1, and alpha 1, so we just get this sign. So this is a very explicit representation of the quadratic term, where we've just used the usual representation of Q, which is the sum of Cn L minus n matter plus 1 half L minus n ghost minus delta n zero. Okay, so that's the BRST operator. This is how to actually calculate the inner product between two things. You take the phi, you hit it with Q, and then you hit it against the BPZ dual of phi, which you define in just this way. Okay, so that gives us the quadratic terms. So for example, if we want to look at the phi squared term, we get phi of minus p, phi of p, 0 hat. Oh, I should mention, by the way, that the vacuum is defined so that this vacuum with a single C naught inside goes to 1. You need ghost number 3, total ghost number, and each of these has ghost number 1. So this is then just going to be C naught L naught minus 1, 0 hat, minus 1 half. And that gives us some term which looks like p squared plus 1 over 2, phi of minus p, phi of p. Okay. So anyway, you can calculate all the quadratic terms very simply in this way. Now for the cubic terms, there are a number of different ways of representing this, and if you look at many of the recent papers, lots of people calculate these things in different ways, but basically they're two different ways of thinking about this phi, star phi integral. On the one hand, this is phi hit into phi star phi BPZ. And this can be thought of either as F1 dot phi of 0, F2 dot phi of 0, F3 dot phi of 0, where we've used three conformal maps to map string states onto convenient places on the real line to calculate a correlator. So this would, for instance, map F1 of 0 equals 0, F2 of 0 equals minus 1, and F3 of 0 equals infinity. And we can write down some explicit functions which do this. And then we just calculate a conformal field theory, correlation function where we use the various fields generating phi and their conformal dimensions and things to calculate that conformal field theory correlation function. Or we can write this as some vertex operator acting on phi star phi star phi, where V is in H star tensor H star tensor H star. Sorry. So let me just do the simplest one of these using this method and then show you how it comes from the two different approaches, and then I'll stop. So one way of writing down these conformal maps is to take F1 is e to the 2 pi I over 3, h of z minus 1 over h of z plus e to the pi I over 3. F2 equals f of f1 of z. F3 equals f of f2 of z, where h of z is 1 plus iz over 1 minus iz to the 2 thirds. If you look at this conformal map, this basically takes you from this semicircle into this 1 third of a circle, where this operator here is mapped to here. And this map F1 then takes that thing here and turns it back into part of the upper half plane where this operator gets mapped to 0. Big F is minus 1 over 1 plus u. And this basically rotates you around between these three points. So the combination of these three gives you a map from three different semicircles into the upper half plane, which allows you to calculate a correlation function of these three things. And now it's just a question of plugging in your S and calculating a bunch of derivatives. So for instance, if we want to calculate the phi cubed term, where phi, again, multiplies C1 acting on the SL2R vacuum, we basically have to calculate things like F prime of 0. We know, for instance, that under some map, you know, that F acting on psi of 0 is f prime of 0 to the d, where that's the conformal dimension of the operator, times psi at f of 0. So we need the conformal dimension in this case of C1. Since C is a dimension minus 1 primary, we just need f prime of 0. This turns out to be 4 over 3 root 3. If we look at each of these terms, f1 and f2 and f3, each basically give us one of those. So if you go through a little bit of algebra, you find that the phi cubed coefficient is g over 3 times 3 root 3 over 4 cubed, which we can write as kappa g times phi cubed, where kappa is just this constant here. Anyway, so to calculate any cubic term, in principle, you have to go through this whole operation. And when you start talking about fields which are not associated with conformal primaries, this starts to get kind of complicated, because now you have to look at the conformal maps on fields which aren't conformal primaries. It gets a little bit messy. And that's where this...
Can I just stop you for a moment?
Absolutely.
These maps, you gave us a pictorial description of what the star product was and so on.
Yes.
Right? So these maps basically implement that pictorial...
That's right. One way of thinking about this is that this is like doing this calculation. We take each of the three string states, and we map it into the disk like this, and then the three operators are sitting out here. And the right half of this string, so now we can think of three strings here, right? And we want to map, so this is 1, this is 2, this is 3. And we want to map the right half of string 1 to the left half of string 2, and the right half of string 2 to the left half of string 3, and the right half of string 3 to the left half of string 1. So if this is 1, 2, 3, we get something like this. And that's the right half of this and this. So you can sort of map it into this, which is roughly what's done by this H. But then to really make it into a conformal field theory correlator, which you usually write on the upper half plane, we just do this extra map, which puts it all in the upper half plane here. So this is basically taking this thing, mapping it into the upper half plane, so it's a more familiar conformal field theory calculation. But this is roughly what we're computing, a symmetric picture where the right half of each string is glued to the left half of the next. Okay? So anyway, you can do this whole song and dance for any interaction, but it gets tedious rather quickly. So there's a very nice formulation by David and Antal, and various other people also, of this vertex representation in which you just write down a set of coefficients, Neumann coefficients, in a way that was, I guess, previously done in the light cone string, and you write this vertex as V equals constant times C11 tensor C12 tensor C13 delta of P1 plus P2 plus P3. This is P. And then you have some exponential of 1/2 alpha R mu, minus N. We'll put it like this. N alpha S M N R S N M plus C R S N M. C N R X R S N M B M S. And this algebraic object where all these coefficients C and X are computable either from power series expansions of this function, these functions, or from contour integrals involving those functions. This gives a nice Fock-space representation of the three-string vertex operator here, which for any set of states you can then just plug in and calculate by doing lots of Wick contractions what the coefficients of any term in the action are. So in terms of actually taking this and calculating to a very high level, which we've been doing on a computer, this is in some sense a much easier formulation to use. So I'm going to stop there, and if there are any questions, I'll take them now, and then we'll let Steve take over with his end of the talk.
So just if you took the action that you get out of all this,
yes,
and at tree level integrate out all the massive fields,
yes,
then I should expect to get the low energy effective action I had before? Is that?
You get something like it, but it's in general related by a non-trivial field redefinition. So it's actually hard to reproduce the, for instance, the Born-Enfeld action in the U1 case from this point of view. If you start doing that, you start seeing that the terms don't look like they agree, and you have to find some field redefinition term by term which maps them into each other. That field redefinition seems to have a finite radius of convergence. So that's actually sort of an unsolved problem. In fact, Justin, I guess, here and various other people have thought about this problem, but it's not yet really resolved exactly how you relate those two forms of the action, but they should in principle be the same.
And what about if I try to include the mass of things as a background in the other way of calculating the effective action? How do you think the thing I did there would be related to this field theory action?
Well, we don't even know in the case of the superstring how to couple all the massless fields to the string world sheet.
Okay.
Trying to couple all the, I mean, maybe somebody here has thought about how to couple all the massive strings to the string world sheet, but I have no idea how to do that.
Okay.
Well, that's part of the idea of boundary strong field theory, for example. It's something
right.
similar, but it's not clear really how to do that because there's a difficulty in regulating
right.
general 2D theories.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's actually exactly what you're trying to do in boundary string field theory. You write down a natural operator associated with each field, but as Steve said, it's hard to regulate. It looks horribly. Okay, so, yeah.
So if you do like one-loop calculations in a theory like this, what sort of things happen? What goes with this? It's completely infinite in all possible ways, or?
I play around with it a little. I haven't gotten anything sensible. I don't know if anybody has ever successfully gotten anything at one loop out of this theory. Yes?
At one loop, do you have a vacuum running in the loop switch, and also so does it mean that any one loop diagram in the bosonic string field theory is just not well defined? And you don't need to care about Shamet objection.
I'm optimistic that there's some way of making sense of it, but I don't know how to do it. So,
I think I'll have some things to say about the one loop.
Good. Yeah, Steve's about to talk about loops, so.
Actually, Greg has.
I just wanted to comment on what Steve said. I mean, in boundary string field theory, you can define the, you can include the mass of fields as an expansion and the coefficient. What you can't do is actually put that into the action. So there is a way of regulating, as long as you have a way of continuing in analytically in momentum. And the momentum of the string fields. Mm-hmm. That's what you do when you define the S matrix elements of massive string fields and just in the Veneziano amplitude. You analytically continue in the kinematic variables, ST, and so on. Mm-hmm. And so that actually does define the correlators of the massive string fields in boundary string field theory. Mm-hmm. Okay. So there are certainly issues. Serious issues with regularization, how you include those in the action, not as just as a series of conformal perturbation theory, but there are ways of regularizing.
Hmm. It's not completely hopeless. We should get you to explain that to us. I'll talk to you about giving a talk after this talk.
Okay. Okay, well, I haven't been thinking about this stuff as much recently as Wadi, so I'm a little rusty, but I wanted to, Wadi asked me to explain some of the ideas about the derivation of the Feynman rules and the role of closed strings in Witten string field theory. So the basic upshot of what I'm going to say is I'm going to explain how the string field theory Feynman rules give you the Polyakov sum over surfaces. And as we'll see, the way that this happens is somewhat non-trivial. A bigger piece of chalk here. So why is this important to understand how this works? Well, there are several reasons. And one is that this is a highly non-trivial check
on the structure of string field theory. And if you don't believe that, then you can ask Barton how many years he spent trying to write down a closed string field theory that satisfies this check. It's very difficult in general. And seeing how it works gives you some insight into how the string field theory, sort of how the string field theory itself works. And in particular, you can turn around this constraint that you should have the Polyakov sum over surfaces and, in a sense, try to think about reverse engineering it. To figure out string field theories, for example, the open superstring field theory, or this is another way of attacking the problem of the finding a closed string field theory is thinking about, and that's part of how Barton went about what he did, is thinking about how to sort of take apart surfaces and turn them into propagators and vertices. When you look at the loop diagrams in the theory, then you're going to learn things about closed strings and their role in the open string field theory. And then finally, this result was really, it was a major, in a sense, success, although only at reproducing something we really already knew of string field theory. And at the time, it was really, there weren't a lot of other successes of string field theory. There was some insight into what the symmetries were, particularly out of some work that, for example, Gary and Andy and so on did on a purely cubic action, but we never really got anything that new out of string field theory. We only learned, in a sense, something that we already knew. That's all we could really do at that time, and it's taken us until now to progress beyond that point. So a reference for a bunch of what I'll say is a physics report where I collected some of this stuff. Plus references therein. And also, there's a paper by Friedman, myself, Shapiro, and Thorne, Nuclear Physics B298, 1988, page 253. Which I'll also mention. Okay, so on to deriving the Feynman rules. So as Waddy wrote down, the action for string field theory takes this Chern-Simons-like form. I guess I differ by an overall minus sign. But
by 1/2 in the first term.
Probably a 1/2 there, at least in some normalization. And this has a gauge invariance where phi is equivalent to the string field shifted by q lambda for some lambda, and then plus the terms linear in the coupling, which I won't explicitly recopy. And so what we'd like to do is understand how to get the Feynman rules, and in particular, Waddy explained some things about the structure of this vertex. But in order to derive the Feynman rules for this action, since it has this gauge invariance, we've got to do a little work. In particular, if you look at the kinetic term here, because of the gauge invariance, the kinetic term is non-invertible, of course. So in order to invert that, we have to choose a gauge. And I'll just briefly explain the gauge fixing at the linear level. The full nonlinear gauge fixing is a little bit more complicated, and I could give you a reference or references where you could learn more about that. But let me just schematically indicate how it works. So in particular, let's take the closed string field and make all of its dependence on the ghost zero modes manifest. So the ghost zero modes are B0 and C0. And so you can write the field in particular as some field that doesn't depend on the ghost zero modes times this down arrow vacuum plus another field that doesn't depend on the zero modes times the up arrow vacuum, where the relationship between down arrow and up arrow is simply that acting on up arrow with B0 turns it into down arrow, and vice versa. Well, and sorry, acting on up arrow with C0 turns it into acting on down arrow with C0 turns it into up arrow. So this is as in Joe's book. And an inspired guess for a gauge fixing condition is the so-called Siegel gauge, or Feynman-Siegel gauge, let's call it. And the Feynman-Siegel gauge condition is that B0 should annihilate the string field. And that means, in terms of this expansion, that the coefficient B must vanish. Now, why is that a good gauge choice? Well, one way of seeing it is to go back to the kinetic operator and show that now, in this gauge, it is invertible. So the kinetic operator is in this Braquette notation, takes that form. And so let's rewrite that using this expansion of phi working in Siegel gauge. And actually, instead of writing things in terms of down arrow, I'm going to write them in terms of B0 times up arrow. So we have the state A, and then up arrow, and then B0, Q, B0, up arrow, and then the state A. And it's a simple exercise for the reader that this quantity with the BRST charge that Wadi wrote down is, in fact, B0 times L0 total, the total zero mode of the zeroth zero zero coefficient. You just see that by commuting B0 through Q and seeing that you pick off, well, Q has a C0, L0 in it, basically. So you just pick off the L0 term. And so this becomes A, L0 total, A, and then we just have up arrow, B0, up arrow, which is one. So now the kinetic operator is just the L0, and that is invertible. So the propagator in this gauge is 1/L0.
You need -1, right?
What's that?
Oh,
this is.
I'm just worried about the normal ordering constant for L0.
Oh, this is, well, okay. That's absorbed into the definition of L0, the way I'm writing it. Well, you can sort that out. Okay. So, L0 includes, the on-shell condition is L0 equals 0 in my convention. Okay, so the propagator is 1/L0, and you can equally well represent that in the form of an integral of e to the minus tau L0. And let's think about what this does in world sheet terms. Well, we know that L0 is the world sheet Hamiltonian, and so e to the minus tau L0 is an operator that propagates a string state for a time tau, Euclidean time tau, and say we have a string conventionally of width pi. So this builds up a rectangle of height tau. And what we need to do is glue together these vertices with this propagator. And so Wadi also explained how that works, and I brought a prop. So here is my prop. So this is the open string vertex. You see, you end up with a surface with a curvature singularity at the point where everything meets in the middle. So in two-dimensional language. And by the way, when he was talking about the conformal map, basically those conformal maps come from the map of this surface to the standard disk, right? That's the mappings he was using. Okay, so the vertex looks like that, and we're basically just gluing the strings together in that fashion. And as I mentioned, there's a curvature singularity at that point. Okay, now the obvious question is, does this really, is this really truly string theory? Does it correspond with the Polyakov definition of the perturbative string amplitudes? And there are actually two parts to answering that question. The first is that of establishing modular invariants. Or slightly different way of saying it is showing that you have a single cover of moduli space. And the second part is that of establishing that you have the correct measure, the Polyakov measure, for integrating over the moduli space of Riemann surfaces, so that you really do recover from this the amplitudes that you know and love. So let's first look at the first question, that of covering moduli space. Now that is not nearly as easy as it sounds. So we're supposed to get the moduli, let's come back to these Feynman rules. So we're gluing together these propagators with this vertex, and we can consider arbitrary multi-loop diagrams, and we'll build up surfaces of arbitrarily high genus. But if you think about the moduli space of Riemann surfaces, that's a very, very non-trivial space. One measure of the complexity of the moduli space of Riemann surfaces is a computation of its Euler character. And its Euler character was found to be given by the zeta function, essentially. And asymptotically at large g, this goes like minus to the g, 2g minus 1 factorial over 2 to the 2g minus 1 pi to the 2g. So it's a complicated space. It has a large Euler character at very high genus. G is the genus. And so
this is the orbifold Euler character.
Right. I believe, yeah.
It's got all kinds of...
It's got cusp singularities. Singularity. Yeah, like we're familiar with in the torus case. On the other hand, here we're, if these Feynman rules reproduce that space, these Feynman rules are reproducing it as a collection of topologically trivial domains, because the only parameters here are just the lengths of the propagators. So we've got copies we've got a bunch of products just of the real numbers. So somehow we're piecing together this complicated moduli space in a very non-trivial way. And in fact, for this reason, this problem is of interest to mathematicians, and it's one way to compute the Euler character of a surface is to break it up into simple domains and then figure out how they piece together and compute the Euler character. Question?
Is it real in theta from minus
T? I think so.
This goes to zero for large negative numbers.
For large negative numbers?
Minus 1 is minus 112, right? It's the sum of integers.
Yeah.
You go to minus 1 over 112, and that is the first few and
whether that's the data of 1 minus 2g is a 2g bit, a Bernoulli number. They go down, and then they go up like 2g factorial.
Okay. I think I got it right. Okay, so...
That wasn't the first computation of that, this Harrer and Zagier thing, which essentially uses this point of view?
I don't recall too distinctly, but it could well be that this was actually computed from one of these cell decompositions.
Yeah, so this is like Harrer and Zagier did it.
Okay, yeah, that's probably right. Okay, so this is non-trivial. Now, let me just give you some flavor for how it works in some simple cases, so you get the basic idea. So, for example, let's think about the first non-trivial diagram that you can draw, and that is the four-point function. So you can consider four-point scattering. And here you just have one propagator. And, of course, this is topologically equivalent. If you think of these strips as going off to infinity, you can conformally map this to the disk, say put one point at infinity, one at 1, one at 0, and then we have a roaming point corresponding to the unfixed state. And so the question is, in the Polyakov situation, if we're computing the amplitude a la Polyakov, we know the correct answer is to take this point and integrate it all the way from infinity to 0, and then, of course, in these other segments, too. But I'll just talk about the infinity to 0 piece. But here we've got a definite prescription for what we integrate tau over from 0 to infinity, and it's not clear that they correspond a priori. And so you have to figure out how to perform this conformal map. And what you learn when you perform that conformal map is you learn that this diagram, which I'll call the S-channel diagram, gives a range of integration here that does not cover the whole interval between 0 and infinity. But of course, you've left something off. You've left off the T-channel diagram. That look a little bit better. You've left off the T-channel diagram, which also has a parameter. And so this is the S-channel. The T-channel, integrating over that, gives you the rest, and they exactly match up and give you exactly one copy of this. That didn't a priori have to happen. You could have had a gap or an overlap. But it works, and you get exactly one cover. So that's the first non-trivial check that this is not nonsense. And so here, in a sense, we have a decomposition of this piece of moduli space into, in essence, two simple domains, two cells, as they might be called. Okay. Now, that's the simplest case. What about the more complicated cases? Well, let me give you another example, which is that of a one that involves the closed string. So, for example, we can take three open string propagators and twist them each once and glue them together. So here are vertices, and I'll put in dotted lines for the midlines of the open strings. So this is an interesting vacuum diagram in the loop expansion, and it's not too hard to do the mental gymnastics to see that actually this is the torus with one boundary. Indeed, let me put in the dotted lines, the midlines of the strings. Basically, they do this. So those are the two vertices. Okay, so here we have a very simple presentation of a piece of the moduli space of the torus with one boundary. And again, it's a non-trivial question to check to see that you indeed get a single copy of the moduli space of this object. The first, well, sort of the naive first thing to do is just check the parameter count, and here you have three parameters. And that's the correct number here. We have basically two parameters, two real parameters, the usual moduli of the torus, and then one the size of the hole, so to speak. Okay, but that's only a zeroth order check, and in fact we know that, well, were it not for that hole, that you have to get this fundamental domain with, of course, the identifications that we're familiar with of the fundamental domain. And indeed, it does work out that if you have this along with other diagrams, that those do indeed give you, in a very non-trivial way, a single copy of this domain. And in fact, there's a theorem that that holds to arbitrary order. So I'll just mention this theorem. So it was proved by a bunch of mathematicians. Thurston, Burdich, Epstein, Mumford, and Hare, basically. And the theorem, which I won't have time to prove or even to precisely state, basically says that this works. Okay? That. Namely, if you look at, well, you get via the Feynman, from the Feynman diagrams of the open string field theory, you get surfaces of course, all possible genus, and with any number of boundaries, at least one, and that you precisely cover the moduli space once and only once.
Can you also construct the unoriented open Bose-Einstein field theory, and do you cover the moduli space with the cross cap?
The theorem I know is for oriented surfaces. I don't know the answer to the unoriented question offhand.
Steve?
Yeah.
I mean, those mathematicians presumably didn't use Whitney's vertex.
No.
So they had another way of saying that you cover the moduli space if you use these simple cells or conjoint in some way. And then you guys showed that you used this theorem when you showed that you could get that from Whitney's string field theory.
Well, yeah. So we have the Feynman rules. They have another way of showing, basically, what you're doing is here you're choosing for each topological surface, you're choosing a definite metric, a definite geometrical presentation in terms of a metric. And what they tell you is actually, without saying anything about string field theory, they come up with the same set of metrics in the course of triangulating moduli space. Now, I can give you the basic idea behind that works. The way that they prove this is they prove that for each surface, each point in moduli space, there exists a unique quadratic differential, namely an object that is, aside from isolated poles, is holomorphic and has two z indices. And the so they proved that this thing, a unique thing, exists. And then the way you go from that to the metric is you define metric via the well, directly via the quadratic differential by basically squaring it and taking the square root. So that is that set of metrics. But how do they prove the existence of these quadratic differentials? Well, let me just give a very rough idea, and that is, let's take the torus, and let's think about embedding a little annulus down here, okay? And we can take that annulus and map it to a standard annulus, standard straight annulus, and compute its modulus. And then what we can do is we can vary that embedding and see how the modulus varies as you vary that embedding. And then you can take this annulus and slowly sort of grow it up until it covers the whole torus exactly once, so it has to meet itself. And then you vary things around until you have the annulus of maximal modulus. And by a sort of compactness argument, you can argue that there is a unique maximum there. There's a little bit more to it than that, but you can find this unique maximum. And the modulus, the annulus that results is exactly, it turns out, in this case, what you would get if you cut this picture along all of the dotted lines. And so this is the midpoints of the three strings.
So this is the theorem for the vacuum diagrams of the open string.
Yes.
Is there a generalization if you put mark points on the boundaries?
Yeah, that's true. The original theorem was only proved for the vacuum diagrams. I think it's a... Basically, you get from the vacuum diagrams to these guys by going to boundaries of moduli space, and you know that all fits together nicely. So it pretty much has to work. Yeah?
In the case of multiple boundaries, is it basically the same thing, but now the condition that it's met that
you're
maximal modulus, do you have to keep the moduli the same or something?
Yeah, you have a constraint, and that constraint is what tells you that in the end, that all the strings have the same width. Okay, so for each of these, you can play with one parameter, and then you maximize some up to that parameter the moduli of all of these things, and then you can choose your parameter so they all have the same height, which is the same half string thickness. Okay, so that is the proof that you have a single cover of moduli space.
Is there a similar proof for boundary open string field theory?
Not that I know of, Greg. I know nothing.
Hasn't been formulated in high and low cases, so it's essentially in terms of the polygon path that they
Well,
But I don't really want to comment on that, because the higher loop situation is definitely
not
there.
Okay. All right, so that is the moduli space. The second question is that of whether you do the right thing on the moduli space, namely, once you get the moduli space, you integrate over it. And the question is, do you have the right measure? So, for example, let's come back to this four-point function. So there is the four-point diagram that I was talking about earlier. And again, there are curvature singularities here and here, as I pointed out. And it turns out, well, there are various ghost insertions. If you're going to think of this as a functional integral over a two-dimensional surface, there are various ghost insertions that have to be present in this functional integral. One is simply that there was that B0 sandwiched between the states in Feynman-Siegel gauge. And so we can represent that as an integral of B over a midline, like that. And then also, because of these curvature singularities, it turns out that there are ghost insertions. In terms of the bosonized ghost, that have a certain, well, they're like fractional powers of C, so that you have the total total ghost charge adding up to the correct number. And so that is a definite prescription that comes out of the written rules, and the question is, does that give you the correct measure? Now, you can actually show that that is the case. You can show that these are the correct thing, such that if you perform a conformal transformation, then you end up with, say, back on the disk, where you have the usual vertex operators, say, for the tachyon, with the fixed picture, meaning that you need to include the C's, the ghost insertions, as you're familiar with from Joe's book, or elsewhere. And then you have here a single tachyon vertex operator integrated with the measure, well, with the correct measure, essentially 1, in terms of this parameter along the boundary of the disk. And so that works. It's somewhat non-trivial to check, but it does work, and you can also show that it generalizes to higher point functions, so higher n numbers of points and higher numbers of loops. And so the upshot is that the way that Witten defined his string field theory does, in fact, give you both the moduli space and the measure for integration. So Witten string field theory does indeed give the Polyakov amplitudes. Okay, now I just had a couple more comments on the role of the closed strings, because that's of potential interest now, and we were just discussing some questions on that. So an obvious question is, do you see any evidence of the closed strings in the open string field theory? And the answer to that, of course, must be yes, because they are evident in the loop diagrams, like, for example, here. If you look at this diagram, this diagram will have a pole. This will have a pole that corresponds to a closed string, basically in that limit of the moduli space. Okay, so what does that correspond to in terms of the propagators? Well, clearly that corresponds to something like, I guess one way of getting at it is to take, say, tau 1 and tau 3 off to infinity. Is that right? Oh, no, that's... actually, I think we want to... Well, let's take them to 0. So you're compressing this loop down to nothing. And in the cross-channel, you get a closed-string pole.
So you put 1 to infinity is also possible, because you want to kind of
what's that?
Small graviton.
Yeah, you take it to 0, and then this is...
The measure goes to 0, huh?
No, they each go to 0, because you want this loop to... this loop to become 0 length, and that's the loop going around the closed-string.
Tusker is the one going around this way, the one connecting the two points is...
Well, I mean, we could have labeled... Well, yeah, tau 3... by tau 3, I mean the one from this point to this point here, and tau 1 is from here to here. So if I take them both to 0, then this cycle, one of the cycles of the torus is going to 0 size. And so...
But in the language of the upper diagram...
Yeah.
The three open string propagators become infinitely long.
No, if they're going to 0, they're becoming infinitely short. Or, well, sorry, 0 length, whatever. Yeah, and only 2 of them. I think that is the right limit. I'm actually going to exhibit a simpler case where you see the closed strings in a second.
Well, Steve, if you can see the closed strings this way, don't you have a closed string field here? You just take them?
Well, yeah.
Go to the
Well, okay, so that's a Good question. The closed strings are present as intermediate states, and we can factorize to find their contributions to amplitudes. That is true. But we don't have any description of an external off-shell closed string.
Can you go to the limit where they look like they're on-shell?
Yeah, okay, but that's only the on-shell. We don't have, say, some functional of off-shell closed string states, which is what we would mean, at least naively, by a closed string field theory. So they're present, they're important, they contribute, but they're not manifest. And in fact, one of the off-shell closed string states are not manifest. And that's been one of the problems that, in particular, Barton worked on for a number of years, is trying to formulate a closed string field theory. And he essentially came up with an answer, but it's so complicated because of this constraint of covering moduli space that it's hard to see how to use it. But time will tell. Okay, let me just indicate a simpler example where you see the closed strings, and that's in this second paper that I mentioned. If you take, well, there's a simple diagram, namely the non-planar the open string non-planar one-loop diagram, which you can represent in Witten's theory, and that sort of is the simplest place where you exhibit the closed strings. So let me draw a picture of that. In the nomenclature of the time, we called this the tank turret. So that's the tank turret, but it's a double tank turret. Schematically, that's what it looks like. You have an open string coming in, and then an open string here and one in the background going around the loop, and then they attach together via another vertex and form an open string. So this is the non-planar one loop diagram. And that has two parameters, namely, let's call this one tau 2 and this one tau 1. And in the limit, when tau 2 and tau 1 go to 0, then this annulus goes to 0 radius, and we expect to find an intermediate closed string pole. So in that limit, schematically, we have a picture that looks like a really skinny annulus, and I've lopped off the external legs here. And basically, the closed string pole is in that channel there. So we actually explicitly investigated that diagram and saw that the closed string poles do arise. But the story is rather more complicated. It turns out that there are lots of poles. As a function of the external momentum, you have poles at minus alpha prime p squared is equal to n over 2 minus 4 for integer n. And the only physical closed string ones that you expect are for n equals 8k, where k is an integer. So we have a lot of extra poles that you see in this approach. And if you take, ultimately, when you look at fully on-shell physical amplitudes, these poles should decouple. And indeed, you also find that to be true. For example, if you take the open string states coming in to be on shell, you project down to just the poles that satisfy the relationship alpha prime p squared is n minus 4. And then if you take them to be on shell and physical, then you finally ultimately project down to just the poles that you're interested in, the legitimate closed string poles. But the moral is there's you get the right thing, but you also get a lot of extra garbage when you're off shell in this representation.
What's the distinction between on shell and on shell?
On shell is L0, you know, P squared equals M squared, L0 equals 0. Physical is all the higher, the Vieira Silva constraints. Yeah. Okay, so an interesting question, sort of in the modern context, is, well, whether this would tell us anything about the closed string, for example, near the tachyon vacuum. Now, Sens, Weibach, and Rostelli have this ansatz for the kinetic operator, which doesn't look anything like the kinetic operator of Witten's open string field theory. It just has ghosts, and so in particular, it won't build up these strips, and you won't see the closed string in this channel in this limit, because there isn't an analogous limit. So there's an interesting set of possible questions you could ask about how you expect to really recover the closed strings, or whether whether this is even the right way of going about it, but you might gain some insight about what's going on with the closed string near the tachyon vacuum. Okay, so let me just conclude, since the time is up, more than up. So the first conclusion is that building string field theories is hard and non-trivial. The Polyakov rules arise through a complicated interplay of the field theory Feynman rules, and it's not guaranteed that you will get the right answer. The closed strings are present in the open string field theory, but you also have all kinds of extra junk to complicate your life. And the ultimate conclusion that we had a number of years ago is that string field theory is really, really hard, and indeed that's been confirmed, but only just now, 15 years later, are we really learning non-trivial new things from it. And maybe it looks like now we have developed some new tools where we can really get something out of it. So it'll be interesting to see where it goes. So, that's it.